Hi, this is Tessa from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This talk was recorded live at DFTB 18. Enjoy the show.
All right, thanks very much, Liz, for the introduction, and thanks to the organisers for inviting me. So I think it's an amazing lineup in terms of breadth and depth, and I'm really honoured to be a part of it, not just in the presenters, but in the people who are attending as well. So I've got to admit, I was pretty unhappy with this talk yesterday, and I ripped it up at midnight and started with a blank sheet of paper. Fortunately, the little clicker has a red button on it, which I'm presuming is an ejection seat. So if it's all going badly, I'm just going to press it and get the hell out of here. Once I started, though, with a blank sheet, what I needed to talk about became clear. And what I really felt that I needed to talk about was a recent distressing case. So I had a little boy who was a month old who presented to a regional hospital with a volvulus, a strangulated bowel. Despite the concern of his parents, it wasn't recognised how unwell he was, and he was diagnosed with a urinary tract infection and admitted to hospital. The significance of a blood lactate level of 5 wasn't recognised early on, and when it was repeated 5 hours later, it was 20, and at that point he was nearly moribund. Things started then to happen. He was diagnosed correctly, transferred down to the tertiary hospital, and finally got to theatre about 15 hours after he'd initially presented. He promptly had a cardiac arrest, was resuscitated, had his bowel untwisted by the surgeon, and was brought back to the ICU. The next 24 hours, my team and I tried desperately to keep him alive, and we fortunately managed, to the point that the next day he'd recovered just enough that we could reopen him and have a look at his bowel. And I felt absolutely sick as I watched the surgeon pull out centimetre after centimetre of dead gut. And I counted with her the 20 centimetres he had remaining. 20 centimetres, it means a severe case of short gut syndrome, a lifetime on TPN, hooked up to a machine every day for the rest of his life, and all the death and disability that goes with that. Now, this wasn't a mistake. This wasn't an error. He actually got the correct diagnosis. He got the correct treatment. There was no one place or person or thing that can cause a 15-hour delay. But the sum total of all of these things was a 15-hour delay and a catastrophe for this patient and his family. The thing that makes this case noteworthy, though, is that the same patient had presented just a couple of weeks earlier with a very similar problem to the same hospital. And that day, it had a dramatically different outcome. He'd been diagnosed promptly. He'd had the surgery that he needed. He'd actually sailed through, got better, and gone home just 2 days before he presented. So we've got this seeming paradox where our same system can produce such radically different outcomes depending on seemingly random factors. The first thing that I said to his family when I sat down with them was, "Your life is completely different." They were furious and confused, as they had every right to be at times, but the thing that really struck me was how courageous, how humble, and how brave they were at accepting their completely new life and the new life for their son. And they asked two things. The first was that we do everything we could for their son, which we did. And the second was that we take the lessons that we learned from examining his and discussing his case to try and prevent it happening to anyone else. So with that in mind, I'd like to convince you of four things. The first is that while we are undeniably making progress, that progress comes at the twin costs of complexity and complacency. The second is that while we do have a knowledge gap in medicine, our delivery gap is far, far larger. The third is that while the gap is larger, it's infinitely easier to close. And the fourth is that there's a reliability revolution starting in medicine, and you too should join. On the way, I'm going to introduce you to a legend of ICU. We'll talk about the most important paper that you've never read, and there'll be two stories about boats. Sound good? Great. All right. So about 10 years ago, I was really struggling with two paradoxes. The first is the one I've mentioned. How can we have so much unwarranted variability? How can the system behave so differently? And the second was, despite that, and despite the fact that almost all of our clinical trials seem to be negative, we keep improving. And I asked Jeff Parkin, who's a legend of intensive care, one of the founding figures in Australia and the world, this exact question. How do we get better when nothing we do works? And he said, oh, it's easy. We just kill fewer people. He said, hospitals used to be incredibly dangerous. I remember a guy catching fire in the operating room. And I remember another poor guy who got hooked up to a filter filled with formalin and was both killed and embalmed in about 30 seconds. So, I mean, I was surprised that this legend of clinical research had said that reliability was actually far more important. But he's right. I'm going to attempt to compress 250 years of medical research into 2 minutes to explain why. So if we rewind, don't have to press the ejection seat button yet. 1747, there are countless numbers of sailors in the Royal Navy dying of scurvy. And this guy, James Lind, decides to have a look at why. He takes 12 people, 12 sailors with scurvy, and divides them into groups, giving one group lime juice and the others whatever the other treatments were. The actual control group got a gallon of beer a day. Not surprisingly, he showed a difference. And that's because these are healthy people, nothing else wrong with them other than scurvy. There's absolutely no treatment other than beer, which may actually be harmful in this case. And then there's a new therapy which comes in and is clearly different. It's easy to see how he could show a difference. If we fast forward just over 200 years to the first trial of the modern clinical era, by this point, supportive care has improved, but there's still no specific treatment for tuberculosis. And in this case, the control group were in hospital and were getting bed rest, while the intervention group got a class of a new wonder drug, these things called antibiotics, and in this case, streptomycin. Because the supportive group or the control group was getting slightly better care than the sailors who were getting beer, they took more people to show a difference. They had about 110 people in the trial. But again, it's not surprising with specific treatment, they were able to show a difference. If we now come into the modern era, we're no longer comparing a gallon of beer or bed rest to some effective intervention. We're comparing the full range of therapies that medicine has to offer, plus probably quite a few specific therapies for that particular condition, to the full range of therapies that medicine has to offer, plus a few specific things for that condition, plus whatever tiny incremental improvement the trial is attempting to examine. And under those circumstances, it's no surprise that despite the enormous complexity and cost of modern trials, the most recent ANZICS mega trial had close to 4,000 people, we routinely fail to show any difference at all. So if we go back to our patient from the start, the game-changing treatments for him were anesthesia and bowel surgery, first done in neonates over 100 years ago. Everything else since then, the blood gas machine, the retrieval system, even, I'm sorry to say, the sexy helicopter, is just an incremental improvement. The game-changing treatments are what he really needed. And the frustration with that patient is that they, the game-changing treatments, are what we failed to deliver, whilst actually getting quite a few of the incremental things to him. The really distressing thing is that that's what the healthcare system as a whole looks like. So in 2003, the RAND Corporation published the most important paper you've probably never heard of. I hope you're keeping track of these things. So RAND is an American not-for-profit NGO that does rigorous quantitative analysis about things ranging from armed conflict to economics. It's the kind of place where Nobel Prize winners like to hang out. And what the people from RAND, with a bunch of clinicians, did is take about 10 big steps back from the healthcare system. And surveying the healthcare system in the US, they said, what are the conditions that cause the most death and disability? What are the top 10? What are the top 20? And what interventions do we really need to do for them? They then investigated about 7,000 people to see how often the things that we know we need to do for the most important conditions actually happen. And the figure, which I hope surprises you, is about 55% of the time. Now, we all know that the US healthcare system is inefficient. It's not as good as Australia. Right, but the same group did the same study in Australia in 2012 and found almost the same result. And this year, a related group, one of the authors is here and I'd actually like to meet them, did the same study in children in Australia and found almost exactly the same result. When it really matters, we get it right just over half of the time. So to talk about the conditions that they were looking at, these are things like in a child who is comatose from a severe head injury, we should immobilize the C-spine until we can assess it. Or, in a child with asthma, sufficiently severe that they've been in hospital, they should have a written asthma management plan. These are things that there would be near unanimous agreement that we should do, and they're things that are evidence-based interventions to improve outcomes in these groups. We get it right about 60% of the time. So in this situation, which we've established with modern science, where game changers, interventions that actually work, are rare, hard to find, and difficult and expensive to prove, the amount of time we actually get them to patients is just better than walking up to the bed, flipping a coin, and deciding what to do. Immobilize the C-spine today, thanks. So, I hope you're shocked by this number. I certainly am and continue to be. And you've no doubt been told by some well-meaning person at some conference somewhere that commercial airlines get it right almost all the time, and we should just be more like airlines, right? But the reality is that airlines do the same thing at the same time with the same people, the same equipment, and the same situation almost all the time, and they do it well. And if you've ever been in an airline where something goes awry, like a plane's cancelled, and see the ensuing chaos, you'll understand that they're actually not that good at managing the kind of complex situation that we have to deal with in healthcare, and the applicability of their situation to ours is limited. So I'd like to leave the air and go back to the sea and to the second story about a boat. So this is a boat. It's actually one of the biggest ones ever built. And on board, it has two nuclear reactors and about 100 aircraft. They take off and land right over people's heads and are actually blasted from the deck on steam-powered catapults. These propellers could clearly slice these guys right in half. And here we see teenagers loading missiles and bombs under rubber pipes filled with jet fuel. I mean, you can't actually imagine a more dangerous situation, right? And this is an American nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, a situation with enormous complexity, enormous uncertainty, and enormous risk of catastrophe at every turn. They should have disasters all of the time, except that they don't. And in the 1980s, a group of scientists, starting with nuclear-powered aircraft carriers, began to ask why. Why are there some situations with comparable uncertainty, complexity and risk to medicine who nonetheless manage to do what they know they need to do almost all of the time? And what they found were that there were reproducible similarities between a range of disparate organizations in the way they were structured, the way they ran, and the way the people in them behaved. So reliability science, or high reliability organizing, is like an ecosystem. The structure, the people, the processes, and the system all support each other. You can't have one without the other. And if you took one element, say you took the culture, or you took the structures and looked at it, you would actually be able to imply how reliable the system was as a whole, just as the same way that if you took a tropical plant, you'd be able to think that it might have come from a jungle because of the way that it's structured. Because it's a science, it can be expressed quantitatively. You can put actual numbers around our ability to do things and give concrete descriptions of the culture at a certain level. So we're just expressing the numbers slightly different here. So before we were talking about our success rate. Now we're actually just talking about our failure rate. So it's just the inverse. So we talked about a 60% success rate is about a 1 in 2 failure rate. So medicine at the moment, on the whole, is around 1 in 2. That's a surprise to me, but it's not a surprise to a reliability scientist because that's the level of reliability that the system that we rely on, i.e. human memory, supports. Under real-world conditions, human memory is just not that reliable. We're not bad people, we're just people. At our best, and I'd like to think that most of the people in the room are probably like this, we approach 1 in 10. So we get it right about 9 in 10 of the time, we fail about 1 in 10. And the things that support that level of reliability are the things that we do. We try and increase our understanding of doing a particular intervention for a patient, we try to be as diligent as we can, and we have a recognized way of doing things. The problem is that when we have a reliability or safety problem, we focus on this level. So we can get up to this level, but then we inevitably fall back down. To actually get above a reliability level of 1 in 10 to the reliability of around 1 in 100, which is probably all that we need in healthcare at the moment, requires more than just you. It requires two things. It requires a cultural shift and it requires a redesign of our processes and our systems. The good news is that this can be done, and it exists already in medicine. There are certain niche areas of medicine, like the induction of anesthesia, where the failure rate approaches 1 in 100,000. And if you've ever spent time in theatre, you'll see the culture ecosystem, the processes and the systems around that that make that such a reliable process. The other good news is that improving our outcomes in health by improving our reliability is just really not that hard. Whereas improving through clinical science is incredibly difficult. Finding the cause of multiple sclerosis, designing a better ventricular assist device for a neonate. These are diabolically difficult problems that we've been working on for decades, and progress will be very, very, very slow and very incremental. We don't need science to tell us that doing something that we're currently doing at 60% of the time at 90% is going to be better. We just need maths. We also don't need to invent this science. It's already been done. The reality is, in 2018, that we spend more effort and have better results at ensuring the reliable production of bottles of tops for milk bottles than we do at ensuring the reliable delivery of healthcare. The other good thing, and for me the really good thing, about changing reliability is that a highly reliable organization looks like the kind of place that we all want to work. A place where, with a respectful and relatively flat hierarchy, because anyone, especially including and especially the cleaner, might have a critical insight into how a particular process could be improved. A place where diversity is truly valued because it gives us so many different vantage points from which to see the world. And a place where everyone is responsible. Our processes and systems need to be designed not as isolated elements, but as interconnected parts of a whole, with the patient journey at the center of that. It's expected that technology and artificial intelligence will play a critical role in this, but unless we have a strong framework on which to put them, they'll just become another gadget which slows us down and makes us worse. So I stand here at the beginning of the reliability revolution in healthcare. I stand with millions, and we're asking you to join us, committing to just four things as you do. First, let's admit we have a problem. Secondly, let's get those with the most to lose and certainly the most to gain properly on board. Let's get our patients and our parents with us. Third, let's commit to radical transparency. And fourth, let's find out more and start acting. Thanks.
You'll need that for questions, Gregory. That was a very powerful talk, I think. And I just wanted to swing that like a stripper. That was a very powerful talk, and I could see people listening and maybe kind of being a bit challenged by it. We have a couple of questions.
We've got a lot of comments. So there's a couple of things that really struck a chord, and one of them that keeps getting repeated is this phrase, we're not bad people, we're just people.
Yep.
And I think that that's a great one to echo and to respect. Perhaps I might, while I'm waiting for other questions to come through, ask one of my own.
Yep.
Is there a danger as we wish for greater and greater reliability that we're going to hit a limit where it costs too much in terms of financial costs, or we're actually going to cause harms in another direction of making a system that's impossibly foolproof?
Yeah, so I think there's two things to say about that. The first is about cost. So there's no doubt that any change does have potential costs associated with it. I think if you're involved in any system at all, looking at something where we only manage to do about half of the things that we think we should do is effectively a chaotic system. And it's hard to argue that would be more cost effective than simply reliably doing what you know you should do. The second thing is about how you actually define reliability, I think. So there's certainly a strong pushback from some elements of medicine because, and that's understandable, because reliability is seen as we simply do the same thing for the same patient. So reliability is not we give every patient a dose of ketazolin before surgery because what if a patient has an allergy? The way the reliability is actually defined is we either give each patient a dose of ketazolin or we document why we haven't done it. Both of those are still compliance with the guideline, and we have to have an ability to do the right thing for the right patient. With reliability, we're not talking about an inability to discriminate or an inability to tailor therapy to a particular patient. We're talking about unwarranted variability. Why might the same patient with the same problem presenting to the same hospital get great care one day and then catastrophically injurious care just a few weeks later? We're talking about reducing that kind of variability, not tailored variability that actually helps a patient.
Do we have another question? Otherwise, I have a question.
Please.
So one of the things about reliability that I think is a huge deficit for us in health is that we have lost the ability to robustly argue about things. So when we have a disagreement, I think it's one of the fastest ways for us actually understanding where the other person is coming from, or perhaps bringing a new viewpoint into the light. But in the days of now being, I guess, at times people are either too politically correct or too backstabby, is that where our reliability deficit is also coming into a chasm in the middle, is that we don't feel like we can say, I disagree with you and these are my reasons why, and that we can't have healthy conflict?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm sure, like all of you, struggled with seeing patients get harmed and seeing suboptimal care through my training, but there never seemed to be a framework about how to improve it other than, oh, we should just try a bit harder next time. And when I found out that reliability could be expressed in terms of actual numbers and that there were actual descriptions of cultures that could move you up reliability levels, it was like a transformation. And the really great thing about that for me as well is that it's not like safety, which is just trying to avoid some occasional catastrophe and kind of seems boring, like we just all need to like tick a whole bunch of boxes. A reliability culture is more about we need all of you at work. So there are some people who are really process-oriented. They love a good checklist and, you know, they'll make sure our forms are really squared away. We need them. And then there are some people like Liz who just love to talk and engage and feel out the temperature of the unit
statement.
And who are really supportive of people speaking up and give people a platform. And we need those people at work as well. So in this reliability ecosystem, we need everyone and we need patients and their families as well.
We've got one more question.
This one, Arjreo. How do we reliably differentiate between unwarranted and tailored variability, especially when there are so many variables in the system?
Yeah, that's a good question. So as I sort of touched on with the first answer, the way that it's usually defined, so these studies are global overview studies. So in those studies, it's a little bit hard to differentiate what's unwarranted versus warranted variability. One of the studies actually did drill down a little bit. I looked a bit more closely at some of the groups of patients and thought that maybe about 10% of the variability was warranted or tailored, but it wasn't documented as such. So I think we must maintain the right to vary care as we see fit for a particular patient. And in terms of discriminating that from unwarranted variability, well, that's really about where you work and how you work. That's the art about how to apply the science in your particular circumstance.
Right. Can you join me in thanking Greg Kelly?